Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Tom Weber. So let's talk food. Specifically, what are the major issues confronting restaurants in the new year? Later in the hour, we'll take an in-depth look at the farm economy. But first, restaurants. My guest is Kim Bartman. Her restaurants include Barbette, been there, The Red Stag, been there, Brian Lake Bowl, been there, and several others. Her latest is Book Club in South Minneapolis. Welcome, Kim.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Doing well. I'm really glad you could join us. But first, we want to hear from you, the audience. What are your questions about the health of restaurants in Minnesota? Thoughts about the future with sustainability, farm to table? Give us a call at 651-227-6000, toll free 800-242-2828. And you can also reach me on Twitter at CFarrellEcon. That's at CFarrellEcon. So, Kim, you recently opened a restaurant, Book Club, but I've been noticing, and a lot of people have been noticing, that many well-known establishments are closing their doors. So is the closures a normal cycle that just happens in the restaurant business or any other industry, or is there something more structural at work?
Chris, I think it's both. There is a quote-unquote normal cycle. It's like 5 to 10 years. I think it's pretty difficult for a restaurant to make it past that. The restaurant that I just opened, Book Club, opened in a spot that had been a different restaurant for exactly 10 years.
Oh, that was Maud's, right? It was Maud's, right?
Cafe Maud.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, so I think nationwide and locally, restaurant business has been a little soft, and there are a lot of conversations out there about why that is. You know, delivery, meal replacement, people not going out as much, all those things. And so I think those are some of the reasons you've seen some places close. But also, you know, we've got sort of a new phenomenon. The last few years, the need for shiny new objects has really increased.
Yes.
So that's sort of a newish wrinkle in the restaurant business. You used to be able to just rely on really great food and really great service, but now just all the bars are being raised, and I think we're all wondering, like, how do we keep established places going? And, you know, just are we going to reach a point some date in the future where only shiny new objects are going to work, and restaurants will have an even shorter, you know, quote unquote, normal lifespan?
Yeah. So one of the things I noticed, so where's the money going to go in the future? I mean, and this is part of that conversation, obviously, that you're having, because one of the things during the downturn, 2008, 2009, we had that downturn. And I remember, I think I have this right, that there was this movement for a lot of places to sort of upgrade their bar food. They would have, it was still reasonably priced, but it wasn't greasy. And, you know, you would have tuna fish burgers as well as, you know, a regular hamburger. So do you see some sort of response to the current environment we're in the restaurant business? Where's the money going to go?
Well, supposedly we're not in a downturn.
Right.
But when you look out at what people are doing with their menus in general, you are seeing a response that feels like a downturn. Like you say, in 2008, 2009, burgers started to be all over the place. Bar food became elevated. You know, more expensive white tablecloth style food started a long decline. And now you see a different version of that. People care a lot more about what they're eating. They want to eat healthier. And so you see a lot of small plates. I think there's also just some cultural shifts in how people want to experience going out to eat. You know, people are going, younger people, I'm old, so I like to sit down and have really awesome service and course out a meal and, you know, have a one-on-one long conversation or something, but people who are younger.
That sounds really nice. I like that.
Yeah, doesn't that sound fun, Chris? But we see a lot more people going out in bigger groups, you know, ordering share plates, that kind of thing. And so, you know, we as restaurateurs are trying to adjust how we provide people with the experiences they want to have in a restaurant.
So give us a call if you have a question for Kim Barton. You can call us at 651-227-6000 or toll free 800-242-2828. Kim, I want to read you something off your website. And there's this line that really struck me about your restaurants. And quote, "Everyone impossible without the farmers and producers that make each menu possible." So what is the state of farmers and producers from your perspective?
Well, which part? Up until recently, I sat on the board of the Land Stewardship Project for 8 years. So I've been, you know, not only just thinking a lot about where am I going to get my chicken from, but also, you know, how do emerging farmers find land? How do they have access to capital? How in the heck do they get access to health care? You know,
right.
How do we take care of our farmers? You know, I think the farm to table movement has been really helpful to our local farm community in that people can make a living selling a smaller amount of things, you know, or a better living, I'll say. I don't know if I want to say a living because I don't know very many farmers who don't have second jobs. You know, and we've also had the urban farming movement sort of explode here in the last several years. And that's been a really interesting thing to watch and be part of. Because of those things, we've had farmers exploring with, you know, heirloom vegetables, heirloom, beef and chicken. So for eaters, I think things are moving in the right direction. For farmers, I think, they still need a lot of support.
So how are the relations between farmers and restaurateurs? I know this is a gross generalization, but, you know, you go into most restaurants and it's about sustainability, it's about farm to table. But what are the relations like?
What are the relations like? Well,
is there a sense of we're in this together, or there's a sense of this
absolutely.
Is more of a zero-sum game, you know, if...
No, I think in general, in especially in, like you say, farm-to-table or sustainable food culture and community in the Twin Cities, it is definitely an all-boats-rise. We're in this together. You know, we have to work together or none of us do well. And especially in that community, it's not a zero-sum game. It's how can I help you? And that extends to, you know, how can I help some of my fellow restaurateurs that support these same farmers? Because we all know we're in the same community. And, you know, if Tracy Singleton doesn't succeed at Birchwood, I might not succeed over here at Barbette, and that means that Pat might not succeed at Wild Acres.
Okay, let's go to the phones, and we're going to Benjamin in Minneapolis. How are you doing, Benjamin?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
Good. So what's your question for Kim?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about the impact of health-oriented restaurants. I know I've seen a pretty big surge in restaurants such as like agriculture, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I just wanted to know if these are going to be happening more or more restaurants are going to be opening up like that.
Okay.
Benjamin, can you repeat that very first part of your question? I didn't quite understand it. The impact of what restaurants?
Health-oriented restaurants. So restaurants that focus more
health.
On, yeah, nutrition, healthy dieting. A certain restaurant I know of is agriculture. It's been a pretty big surge in Minneapolis recently.
Okay, so this is a lot about the kale and the brown rice, and you know, this is rather than going to the fast food McDonald's at lunchtime or at dinner.
Yes. Well, Benjamin, I personally like that kind of food. I think I was at Agriculture a couple weeks ago, but I do think you're going to see more attention to healthy foods. You know, vegetables are definitely migrating towards what we call in the industry the center of the plate. You know, typically the center of the plate refers to beef or pork or chicken or seafood, but I think you see more vegetable-centric dishes popping up on menus all over. And, you know, the other thing about agriculture is that it's a counter service place, and it's more of a customizable meal. And so, you know, people can eat healthier that way when there are places where you can sort of pick and choose what you want to build your meal out of, like kale and brown rice, for instance.
All right, let's go out of the Twin Cities, go to Brainerd. And Ed, you have an insight to share?
Well, yeah, thanks for taking my call. My wife, Sarah, is actually a new restaurateur, opened a restaurant here, I think, just beginning of December. So.
Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Barely into the second month of Sage on Laurel, downtown Brainerd. But anyway, I think a lot of, and she's the main person on that. I'm just the silent partner, but she's certainly trying to go beyond the typical bar food, certainly have options for vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free, you know, ethnic food, kind of something beyond your sort of conventional Perkins sort of fare, for lack of a better word, that seems to be all over the place, and certainly been a good experience so far. And I think a lot of what your guests are saying sort of rings true to what she's been doing up here.
And so are you tied into the more rural community around Brainerd with some of the local farmers, producers?
I think definitely. I think she's sourcing some things locally and looking to, you know, certainly do more of that when possible. Obviously, seasonally, local produce isn't busting off the shelves this time of year, but I think that is certainly on the agenda. And obviously, as we get into the season when things grow, there'll be more things in that department. And that's an advantage of being in this area, is you're closer to those kind of sources.
Yeah. So, Kim, does this make you feel good when you hear about someone opening a restaurant?
Absolutely. I mean, well, I feel excited for them because opening a restaurant is a really thrilling experience. It's also a grueling experience of a lot of hard work, both mentally, emotionally, and physically. I'm really excited to hear that someone in Brainerd is trying to bring another, you know, level of, you know, healthy options to, you know, a menu that's not just a bar menu. That's really exciting to me because that, you know, makes me feel like I'm heading in the right direction too.
Yeah. So I want to go to Gray in Minneapolis. And what is your comment, Gray?
Good morning. I called in when you first asked about why people aren't eating out so much.
Okay.
And I've been on hold. I love to eat out, and I love farm-to-table and new restaurants, and I'm a healthy eater. But what I've noticed is I leave the restaurant a lot of times not feeling very good about my purchase because of the service. And it's because I feel like these restaurateurs feel the need to hire, like, edgy, cool people who might not necessarily have the most experience or be the best problem solvers, or now know how to say yes to customers' requests. And so sometimes I feel like it's even been kind of rude, like there's pride in being kind of, you know, having a negative attitude. And so since I'm in a job where I give service, you know, I'm really looking forward to getting some when I go out to eat. And I would be fine if somebody looked like a mom or looked like me, as long as I got some good service.
Kim?
They don't have to be cool to fit the restaurant image.
Yeah. So what do you...
Yeah. I hope that no matter what anyone looks like, they still are working in a restaurant because they love to give good service. You know, that should be what's happening in all restaurants. I'm really heartened to hear that you want to have that true, you know, hospitality experience when you go out to restaurants, because it not only, you know, from your perspective, it feels like maybe there isn't as much emphasis on that lately as there should be. And I do feel that you're right. There seems to be kind of a, I don't know, like an industry slide in focusing on making sure we are providing true hospitality, but also that some customers don't care too. They seem to not care.
Is there also greater demand on you for training? Because I'm thinking about, we have a very low unemployment rate in Minnesota, very low in the Twin Cities. Twin Cities is the tied for first as far in nationwide with metropolitan areas in terms of its unemployment rate being so low. So if someone has a choice to go work for a nonprofit, they can go work for a business, they can go work for a restaurant. I would imagine it's a tougher labor market.
We are in a very tough labor market these days, and there is definitely always a stronger need for, you know, better training for folks, better training in the front of house so that people are giving good service and that they know their product. Because what's the point of selling, you know, Larry Schultz's organic chicken if the server doesn't know anything about it? You know, you need to be able to talk about that kind of stuff. And then in the back of the house as well, we have a huge shortage of cooks and people to work in the kitchen. And so a lot of training is happening.
Yep. And I just want to say to anyone listening to this, this also means if you're looking for experience, you're looking for a job, it's a good time, it's a good opportunity. Approach a restaurateur. Odds are you're going to get hired.
It's a great time. If you know how to work and you can show up and do the work, you will always be able to find a job in any city in America.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Kim Bartman is a restaurateur. Among her establishments is Barbette, the Red Stag, and Bryant Lake Bowl. Her latest is Book Club in South Minneapolis. The past several years have been tough on many farmers. Farm income has steadily dropped since 2013. Farm debts are high and rising. So what's the outlook for farmers in 2018? What are some major policy issues farmers confront in the new year? My guess? No farming. Sarah Wyant is editor and publisher of AgriPulse. It's a comprehensive weekly report with the latest in agricultural information. Her publication covers both farming and rural news. Welcome, Sarah.
Good morning, Chris.
And Bruce Babcock is an economist at the University of California, Riverside. Now, among his many publications on the farm economy, policy papers like these caught my eye: Safety Net Design for the New Farm Bill and Judging the Performance of the 2002 Farm Bill. Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I want to give out the number because we would like to hear from you. What do you want to know about the farm economy? Are you a farmer? We'd love to hear from you, too. Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free at 800-242-2828. You can also reach me on Twitter at CFarrellEcon. That's at CFarrellEcon. So to start off, I want to ask you both the same question, and I'll address it to you first, Sarah. The past few years have been hard on farmers. So what is your outlook for 2018? Is it more of the same, or is there an upturn waiting to unfold?
Well, Chris, I do believe that there seems to be some stabilization in the ag economy. As you mentioned, the last 3 years have been showing consecutive losses, but USDA is predicting that at least for 2017, things seem to have stabilized and farm income is actually up a little bit, $1.7 billion. Still, the average is expected to be somewhere around $63 billion, far below the highs that we saw in 2012 and 13. So there's a lot of uncertainty in ag country right now. Of course, it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario where sure. Bruce is sitting out in California. Things look a lot different for the fruit and vegetable folks than perhaps they do in my home state of Iowa. And so we see farmers being very cautious about how they're going to proceed in 2018, especially as they look at changes in perhaps trade policy and a new farm bill.
And Bruce, I see you traded the Iowa for the warmth of California.
I sure did. It's a good winter to do that.
I'll say a very good winter to do that. I'm a little bit jealous right now. So what is your outlook? What are you focusing on?
Well, you got to remember that when we refer to 2012 and 13, those were all-time record income years for farmers. So a lot of farmers put a lot of money into the bank, if you will, and made a lot of investments. And that have tied them through lower prices over the last 4 years. And as I agree with Sarah, over the last 4 years, we've seen lower prices, but they haven't been calamitously low, if that's a word. They've been lower
we'll
than record.
It. That's a good phrase. It's okay.
Yeah, it's been roughly stable prices for the main crops, corn, soybeans, and wheat. And I agree with Sarah, for 2018, kind of more of the same, more stability. But, some dark clouds on the horizon with trade policy, I think. Farmers were poised to, U.S. farmers were poised really to take advantage of greater access to foreign markets through the trade deals. And that has all been reversed because of the election. So I think that's a dark cloud on the horizon.
Okay. So I wanted to get to the trade deals. But Sarah, before we do that, so I've been doing some reading about the farm economy, and there's this concern that seems to be out there, has been written about, that we could see the biggest wave of farm closures since the 1980s. I mean, that maybe Mel Gibson and Sissy Spacek will get together and do a sequel to their 1984 movie about losing the farm. Is this exaggerated, this fear? That seems to what both you and Bruce are saying.
Well, I was in Iowa when Jessica Lange came into film country in the 1980s. And, that was really a harsh time because you had the combination of not only low prices, but you had the incredible spike in interest rates. This is not the 1980s. This is a time where you're probably going to see some continued consolidation, where you're going to see some folks who are perhaps over-leveraged, have to get out of the business. A lot of folks are tightening their belts, and as Bruce referenced, they had been able to pay off some debts during those go-go years of the 2012 and 2013. And so those who were able to consolidate some of the debt and be conservative during that time are still going to be just fine. I do think it's going to be tougher for young entrants into the business, and some of the older entrants who might want to get out are finding a difficult path forward to see how they still monetize their exit.
And Bruce, let's go to the North American Free Trade Agreement. I mean, President Trump, so TPP, which was the agreement in Asia with 11 nations, we decided not to join that. And then the North American Free Trade Agreement's being renegotiated, but there's this constant threat that it just might be torn up. How concerned, why are farmers concerned about the North American Free Trade Agreement?
Well, the NAFTA enabled Canada, United States, and Mexico to develop what economists call rational supply chains, low-cost supply chains. So the agricultural sectors and many other sectors also, but we're talking about agriculture today, they were able to integrate quite effectively and efficiently. So things that Mexico was really good at producing, they produced. And then things that products that United States was really efficient at producing, they were able to focus their attention on those. And that includes lots of livestock products, corn, wheat, lots of crops. And so U.S. agriculture has become dependent on those supply chains and the access to Mexico. And the threat of losing that, it really is disruptive of the business model that has been set up successfully over the last 20, 25 years. And so that's, I think that that's a big concern for U.S. agriculture right now.
And Sarah, what are farmers telling you about the North American Free Trade Agreement?
They're nervous. They're incredibly nervous, Chris. When you look at, and especially in your state of Minnesota, That state is ranked number 4 in agricultural exports. About 30% of net farm income on average is attributable to exports, and a big part of the export picture is Mexico and Canada under NAFTA. I mean, we've had such tremendous gains starting back in 93, where we were exporting about $9 billion in products. And now in 2016, that increased to $38 billion. I mean, we're talking a huge financial hit if these trade agreements would go away.
So I have a follow-up question to this, but before I ask that, give us a call. Do you have a question about the farm economy? Are you a farmer? What is your experience? What is going to be, do you think, will be your experience in 2018? So call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. So, Bruce, one of the things that surprised me when I was doing my research is I grew up with the notion of, American farming fed the world. And yet the share, we're looking at grain, but the share of global grain trade has fallen from 65% in the mid-70s to 30% today. So what are some of the implications for U.S. farming having a smaller share of the global market?
Well, there's a couple implications of it, but one big reason that the U.S. share of these of exports of grain have fallen is just the development of agriculture in South America primarily. Brazil and Argentina have become powerhouse exporters, and what that means is there's more competition out there in terms of U.S. Exports, and more competition means that if we're going to blow up NAFTA, if you will, Brazil and Argentina are right there ready to take that market. And so there's more competition. And so I think that trade agreements where you have predictability and develop relationships, long-term relationships, predictability are more and more important for U.S. agriculture.
All right, I want to go to the phones. And Luke has been waiting patiently on the line. Luke, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. So what is your observation or question?
Well, we have a family farm for three generations, and this is the first year that we're not going to put any seed in because the seed prices are too high for Monsanto.
So what are you going to do?
We're not.
Just let it lie fallow?
We're not going to do anything with it, or we're still trying to figure it out. We don't know.
So, Sarah, does this surprise you? Is this something you've heard?
Well, I haven't heard from any farmers who have told me they're not going to plant anything as a result of the high prices, because there are a lot of smaller plant breeders that are selling more conventional seeds that aren't as expensive. But I have heard that, as people look to tighten their belt, they're shopping around a little bit more. And, you know, the yield potential of these really high-class genetics that are offered by companies like Monsanto and Syngenta and others, they're a lot more expensive. So I can feel the pain that he's expressing there. It's a little bit of looking at, okay, what level of investment do you still get a profit from whatever seed selection that you make? And I think a lot of people are also looking at switching from corn to soybeans this next year. The expectation is that, the lower costs involved with producing soybeans may be a better outlook for some farmers.
Okay. Now let's go to Kevin Papp. And you're near the farm near Garden City. Is that correct?
That's correct. In the snowstorm today.
Well, I hope you're staying warm. And so what is your question or observation?
Well, maybe a little bit with the fact of taking issue of our prices were higher. We did reinvest. I don't believe in our case, and a lot of farmers not so much put the money in the bank as was explained. Most of that money, those returns, went back into the farm, whether it be new technology, things like precision agriculture to make us more sustainable. But a lot of that was reinvested into the farm or, quite frankly, used to pay off bank notes and bank loans on some of those long-term debts.
Yeah. Okay. So, Bruce, what is your What's your comment to that? Because I think he's reacting to something you said.
Right. I guess I was a little inaccurate or inexact when I said put it in the bank. What it really farmers did is make their balance sheets, strengthen their balance sheets, and invest. And then when they invested, most of them did not invest highly leveraged investments. They, you know, they paid for things because they had the resources to pay for things. So, yeah, I think the balance sheet of U.S. agriculture coming out of the 2013-2014 was very strong. And so some weaker years subsequent to those have not caused large financial stress in the sector.
And here's a really naive question, Bruce, but how important is the farm economy to the U.S.? I mean, it's what, less than 2% of the workforce?
If you were to measure it by percent of GDP or percent of labor, it's not that important. That is, downturns in the farm economy will not be reflected in downturns in the national economy. But of course, the farm sector doesn't like to look at it that way because there's lots of downstream employment involved when getting us all the food that we eat and everything. And so the processing sector and the value-added sector to downstream from primary production of agriculture, it's more important. But that will go up and down more with national economic conditions. And so it's really the downstream sector that's more important.
And the John Deere national. Tractors and all of that.
That's right.
Great. So, Sarah, how important is the farm bill that's going to be negotiated in 2018? Is this a big deal? It's just, you know, this is just something that, you know, gets routinely negotiated, or is this something farmers are really paying a lot of attention to?
Well, they do pay a lot of attention to this, Chris, and I'd just like to elaborate a little bit more on your previous questions,
sure.
Because all Americans eat, or would like to eat, last I checked, and, you know, we're very, very fortunate in this country that because of the production system that we have from farm to fork, you know, Americans pay a little around 10% of their disposable income for food. So maybe we're not measured in the ag sector, you know, when you look at it just from a GDP standpoint, and Bruce is very correct on that, and less than 2% of the population. But when you look at the overall impact that American food production has on consumers every day, I think it's quite large. So when you look at a farm bill, it's not just about farmers. They are very in tune to what's happening in terms of risk management and price supports and farm safety net. But the farm bill also encompasses things like helping promote exports from the U.S., helping rural development and encouraging the development of hospitals and daycare and things like that in rural areas, expansion of broadband. It's a very comprehensive bill that addresses many segments of rural America. And as farm groups are starting to look at the possible markup of a bill in the first quarter of 2018, they're all very focused on what could be included in that measure.
So let me follow up with that. We just had a massive tax cut signed into law by President Trump toward the end of 2017. And now you have this discussion coming out of Washington, summarized by the expression, we can't afford. And how concerned are farmers that as they're negotiating this bill, as they're, you know, putting forward the programs they'd like to see, that the message they're going to get is, you know what? We'd love to help you out, but boy, we just did this massive tax cut. We got this big deficit. We actually can't do that much.
Right. Well, there is a concern about that. I mean, when you add, you know, a trillion or $1.5 trillion to spending and to the deficit, it's a huge impact. But there was an agreement that they would not do a pay-go against the farm bill, that there would not be resulting cuts as a result of what they did with the tax measure. And we went around to people around the country asking them, how do you see the tax reform package impacting you? And I did hear from like Mark Watney, who's with North Dakota Farmers Union, being very concerned about the debt that's going to be resulting from the tax reform and how this might impact the farm bill. But in the most part, I heard farmers very, very positive in how they're going to have lower rates. They're going to be able to still deduct some things when they do start needing deductions again, which they don't right now for the most part. But when the economy can improve and they can start buying things again, they think they're in a really good place for the most part with the tax reform package.
So, Bruce, what are you focusing on with the, you know, the negotiations around the new farm bill?
Well, about a large proportion of the cost of the farm bill is actually nutrition programs, the Supplemental Nutrition for Assistance Program, SNAP, and it's by far the biggest. And what you hear out of some parts of Washington is the need to reform welfare programs, and welfare programs, the number one welfare program is the SNAP program, which is part of the farm bill. The last farm bill that went around in 2013-14, some Republicans wanted to split the nutrition part of the farm bill out of the farm bill, and old hands in farm policy said that would be a disaster. So what I'm looking for is whether or not there's going to be similar attempts to separate the nutrition programs from the farm programs, because what that would do is it would likely not the end of farm subsidies, but the farm subsidies really depend on urban legislatures voting for them in exchange for getting on the nutrition programs through. So I'm looking to see if how the politics of the SNAP program play with in the new farm bill.
And Sarah, I think one of the titles, if I jotted it down right, from AgriPulse is speaking about SNAP, is it part of the farm bill or is it part of entitlement reform?
Well, there's going to be some adjustments in the farm bill on SNAP. The extent of those have yet to become public, but I do expect that there will be something along the line of changes in requirements for work for able-bodied adults without dependents. As you know, Chris, that is a work requirement that's currently in the SNAP provisions, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. And we expect that some of the waivers that are currently available right now to states, I see even Minnesota has a partial waiver in parts of the state, but some states just waive this requirement. And I think there could be some tightening on that comes in to the farm bill. Now, whether that will appease the folks who really want bigger entitlement reform is yet to be seen. Speaker Ryan has made a big deal about comprehensive entitlement reform, and we'll have to wait and see whether what Mr. Conaway does in the House Ag Committee is sufficient to block any further entitlement reform. But Bruce is exactly right. We need to have the nutrition programs move with the farm parts of the farm bill in order to pass the House and the Senate. They split it before and it didn't work, and it's not going to work again, given the numbers that are available right now.
Okay, well, I want to go to Betsy Jensen. I believe you're a farmer from Stevens, Minnesota. Is that right?
Yeah, Stevens, Minnesota.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for calling. And you're going to raise a topic that I was going to shift to, so I'm going to let you make the shift to the topic.
All right, increased regulatory reform. That's something that I think is impacting quite a few farmers at the moment. And that certainly is a concern, especially as we look at tight commodity prices going forward. We're still trying to navigate the new regulations that are being proposed, both on buffer strips, which many of those
are. So this involves water. A lot of this is about involving with water?
Mostly with water. I can't say water. Mostly with the environment, water includes also soil erosion, cover crops, everything to try to keep our soil in place and to keep our water healthy.
So, Bruce, what about this issue about the environment, water? There's been a lot of ferment in this area.
Well, there has, because the number one source of pollution to our rivers and streams and lakes is agriculture, non-point source pollution. And so as people want cleaner water, you really have to look to agriculture do more. You know, farmers like to say they are the primary stewards of the land, and I don't disagree with that, but the fact is that they are the big source of pollution to our water. So if we want to clean up our waterways, we're going to have agriculture do more. The problem is how do you get agriculture to do more? And right. Agriculture says, well, we need to be paid for it. And where's that money going to come from? And so there's a lot of debate about where the funds are going to come in order to induce farmers to do more to clean up water supply. So that's an ongoing debate, and I think that will also be a focus of the next farm bill.
So, Sarah, anything to add?
Well, I do agree that farmers are the original environmentalists because they live where they work, and if their water supplies are tainted in any way, that's hard for them personally as well as publicly. And I also agree that water quality and soil health, which often go hand in hand, are going to be key issues as we look at the next farm bill. Now, where there's going to be any new money is yet to be seen. It's always the biggest fight over where the dollars could come from. And that's why I think you're seeing a lot more public-private partnerships. You're seeing more states step up their game by providing funding. Iowa recently did this. Because there are a lot of costs between trying to put in not only buffer strips, but let's say cover crops that might not always work in some environments, depending on when they're planted. We've got bioreactors going in. We've got a lot of different tools that are being implemented. But it's tough, especially when there's nitrates naturally occurring in the soil. If farmers did nothing, it's already there. So it is going to be a big initiative, I agree, going forward to 2018.
So, Bruce, you think that farmers and environmentalists can find common ground? There was an article in the Washington Post, I believe, yesterday, and it was out in Iowa, and it was about water and the regulations and then being overturned. And what was kind of interesting about the discussion was the hatred of the regulations, but then there's almost like a pause, ... but we want clean water.
Yeah, that's a big dilemma, and I think that report was about the Waters of the United States regulation. Obama administration,
that's right, yes.
passed a clarifying rule that said, well, what waters were subject to the Clean Water Act, led by the American Farm Bureau campaign against that. Really put the fear into farmers that the big hand of government was going to come down and regulate how they were going to operate their lands. And so the new EPA has basically, and the Corps of Engineers has rescinded that rule. But then what are we left with? So the rescinding of the regulation doesn't mean that the problem of runoff of nutrients into waterways has ended. In fact, it hasn't ended, and so we're still going to be faced with that problem.
Well, let's go to Murray, and I believe, Murray, you're in Beardsley, Minnesota?
Yeah, that's correct.
So what's your observation?
My question is, what do the panelists and you think about the impact of the Trump administration, you know, trying to take a tougher line with like Mexico and Canada, where we sell a lot of our products or overseas, and how those countries may react in either buying or not buying our products that are needed as part of the farm economy.
And I'm curious, is this a question you're interested in, or is your livelihood tied into the farm economy?
I'm not a farmer. I live in a farm community, though. My wife grew up on a farm, and I'm just concerned about how it will impact the farm economy, like in Minnesota, for example.
Okay. Bruce?
Well, I think the Trump administration's approach to trade agreements is completely misguided. I don't think that there's really any interest group in the United States that actually is in favor of the Trump administration approach to NAFTA. There is no real benefit to the United States from what he's doing to NAFTA. So, and I think that, as Sarah said earlier, the Minnesota agriculture is highly dependent on exports. U.S. farmers produce so much more products than is consumed in the United States, and they rely on export markets. So I'm not sure why he's doing it. I think it's misguided.
And Sarah, I mean, one of the puzzles I have is there's all this negative talk about NAFTA, but the farmer's voice doesn't seem to be breaking through.
Well, there has been some impact. When you have the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross suggest that farmers should really stand down a little bit from the comments that they'd been sharing, I think that he's definitely heard this. I think President Trump has definitely gotten the message. But what we can't tell right now is, as in any good negotiation, you have to be able to walk. And so it's unclear how much of the negotiating rhetoric that we're hearing right now is to try to have this drumbeat of really strong negotiating strength versus, being able to walk away. No one in agriculture thinks that they're really going to walk away, but as I said earlier, they're very anxious. And I think you're also seeing countries like Mexico saying, okay, well, we need to have certainty in our supply. So we are already trying to work with Mexico and other to work with South America and in other areas to see if they can have Plan B in place in case the Trump administration does pull the plug. But I have to mention also, there are some problems with NAFTA. If you talk to the tomato growers who are concerned about some of the snapback regulations are in Minnesota, I think you're going to have a lot of dairy folks who are concerned about what Canada has done on dairy. And so there are some things that the U.S. ag community would like to see changed. And as we reported in our newsletter this week, even if nothing has changed in NAFTA, I think U.S. negotiators plan to file a complaint against Canada and the World Trade Organization against what they're doing on dairy.
Right. And I think a lot of this has to do with, do we act unilaterally, or just as you said, do you file with the World Trade Organization, which is this multilateral organization that sort of says we're going to continue to, have a big stake in this global trading system?
Yes. And this Class 7 pricing mechanism that Canada has developed is both blocking U.S. dairy exports and at the same time subsidizing its own exports. So it's really stealing market share away from the U.S.
So, Bruce, we talked about particularly about SNAP with the new farm bill. What about crop insurance or agricultural risk coverage? Are these going to be particularly contentious, or is there a fair amount of agreement along those lines?
Well, within agriculture, there's a almost unanimous agreement that the crop insurance program should not be touched. But when you go, if agriculture is faced with fewer resources, it's pretty easy to find some low-hanging fruit, if you will, from the crop insurance program, from the safety net program, that could be taken and without really affecting the ability of farmers to use the program to manage risk. So it really depends on what the budget situation is going to be like for agriculture about whether or not these safety net programs are going to be touched.
Okay. And Sarah, what else are you watching with the farm bill that you feel we should be really paying attention to?
Well, this farm bill is going to be dramatically different in terms of policy changes compared to the last one. The last one was an effort to reduce or eliminate direct payments that was done in favor of a different safety net for farmers and ranchers. And so this is going to be probably more of an evolutionary than revolutionary farm bill. You'll see some negotiations around changing the safety net for the agricultural risk coverage and the price loss coverage program. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but that'll be one of the things that will most likely be changed, in addition to some additional price support for both dairy producers and the cotton folks who, as a result of a previous World Trade Organization case, opted for a safety net that didn't seem to work very well, and so now they'd like to come back up under our commodity program. So that will be kind of the key playing ground. But you're also going to see folks ask for more research dollars, more work on conservation, more work for a disease bank to help livestock producers prevent disease. So there's a whole host of other asks in this farm bill, but I think the focus will be on some minor changes in the commodity programs.
Well, thank you very much to both of you. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
Sarah Wyant is editor and publisher of AgriPulse. Bruce Babcock is an economist at the University of California, Riverside. I'm Chris Farrell.